Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is Dom Evans, living right outside Detroit, Michigan. Dom is a filmmaker, activist. We had him on the show last year for the episode on the Spaces music video, which he directed. Dom, really excited to have you today and be able to talk with you more about your work and just your story in general.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here to talk about the work I'm doing and how important I feel it is for the disabled community. And, you know, the SMA community is a part of that. So,
absolutely. And also, I wanted to say congratulations, because I believe, like, since we did that episode last year, Spaces has won several awards and been nominated for others, I believe. But it was it for a music video of the year, I think,
if I'm not mistaken? Yes, we won music video of the year at the Wavy Awards. It's gotten a lot of recognition in the last year, and I hope that it will go even further, because I feel like the video really is meant to be to show that those of us with SMA are talented artists and musicians and filmmakers, and I think that it does a really good job of showing that.
Oh, absolutely. Well deserved. And for listeners, if you haven't gotten, check out that episode and the music video, be sure to go check both of those out. Before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. Whether you are living with SMA or are the parent to a child with SMA, make a choice today that could impact your future. Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay, so Dom, to get started, can you just tell a little bit about when you were diagnosed with SMA and what it was like for you growing up with a disability?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with SMA when I was 4. I was told I had Wernicke-Hoffmann for years, which was a bit confusing because I walked until I was 16. And typically Wernicke-Hoffmann is considered type 1. You don't usually walk. So there were a lot of mixed messages for me about what SMA meant, because when you hear Wernicke-Hoffmann, a lot of times people are like, well, you're going to die, you know. So, but it's like the doctors didn't really know with me. They wanted to believe that I would somehow not die and that I would somehow be like this. I don't know how to describe it, like this case that just was unlike all other SMAs. Like, I would be successful and I would, you know, have a life, you know, and that's how it was presented. You could possibly have a life, but then there was all the telethons and all the other messages with, well, you're gonna die. So, you know, it was very mixed messaging for me throughout much of my childhood, and that came with a lot of internalized ableism. Nobody ever sat me down and said, you're disabled and this is what the world's going to be like. And I think that disabled kids really need to have that conversation. Parents need to be telling them the world's not going to be nice to you, because if you don't hear that, at least in my case, I spent this whole time thinking I would have a life similar to my peers. And then when that didn't manifest, I thought I was lacking, because if everybody else could get, you know, could date, or they could go out and have fun with their friends, or, you know, I wasn't allowed to do those things because it was harder to get me places. It was harder to want people to want me to be, you know, people didn't want to accommodate me because it was more work. So, like, but I expected it, you know, because society, the, you know, it told me it gave me this mixed messaging that I deserved it. So when I did not have access to these things, when I was treated with ableism, you know, you get angry about it because you're supposed to be like everyone else. You see yourself as like everyone else, but society doesn't see you that way. So that's what I really had to deal with, was like not having the same perception of myself that society did. So now that I'm an adult, it's been a process of recognizing through therapy and other things that, you know, people didn't feel the same way about me that I saw, you know, they didn't see me the same way I saw myself. I saw myself as a fully realized human being that had wants, needs, desires, dreams, you know, but society didn't see that. They just saw me as this little cripple girl that really had nothing to offer, or that what I had to offer could be exploited for money, for the organizations that would benefit from my cuteness and from my proximity to being non-disabled. Because, you know, if I just sat there, that was the thing that really pushed through the message that I was only worth what I could offer society, was that I was engaged with MDA and the MDA telethons. I was a poster child, and that was my worth. What I could give MDA was what I was worth. So performing and, you know, fundraising, all of that stuff became so integrated into who I was as a person, because my worth became about what I could make other people. It was not about what I was worth as a person. It was about what I could give to the world as a cripple person, basically. And I say cripple very specifically because there's this idea of cripple being less, you know, not even a fully disabled person, you're a cripple. And that's what it was. So all my messages were, you're worthless. You're nothing. You're only as good as the money that rolls in for MDA. You're only as good as what you can do to raise money. So you gotta beg them. You gotta plead. You gotta show them that you're, you know, you could have a life, because how devastating would that be to have somebody that could have a life, but because of their disability, you know, they can't. And that's the great lie we tell, too, isn't it? That we can't have lives because we're disabled. I knew I could have a life, you know, and for MDA to say, if you just donate and cure this adorable little cherub here, they can have a life. How does that influence your self-esteem? I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm the case study for that, right?
No, and absolutely. And thanks to you so much for sharing that. And you know, I before I got to know you, I was introduced to your work like through Twitter, and saw kind of the activism you were doing both in the disabled community and the LGBT community. And you know, you talked here about finding your worth and finding your passion. So, what was that journey like in terms of discovering, you know, your passion for filmmaking, passion for activism, and finding worth in those things and many other?
I think it was a natural progression from where I was. You know, I've tried to find ways to talk about being a poster child, because that was such an integral part of my life. I wanted to be an actor pretty much my whole life. My first dream was to be a dancer. And they were basically like, well, you're disabled, you can't dance. So to hear that when you're four, and realize, well, you're just not capable of doing something, that's a really big revelation that a lot of four-year-olds can't make, that I'm incapable of doing this. So I said, well, fine, if I can't dance, then I'm going to perform some way. And so I turned my kind of mindset towards acting. And so for the next decade, at least, I would say decade to decade and a half. So not quite two decades of my life were spent in this world where I was an actor. And that was really rewarding in ways because I was talented enough that directors would look past my disability. I had a director create a ramp. It was a rickety old ramp, but he wanted me in his show so bad that he took his own resources. This was a little rinky-dink theater, didn't have any funding. He wanted me to be in his musical. He was just like enamored by my talent. And that was the kind of thing people, when they saw that I had talent, they would kind of look past the fact that I was disabled. And I really wanted that. I didn't really recognize that I should want them to look at me with my disability, not past it or beyond it, you know? But it was the way that I was able to participate was through performing. Everything else in my life was horrible. I was picked on everywhere. I was bullied and tormented. And I really poured my heart into acting and later singing. I was an opera trained and Broadway trained singer for years. I was talented. I believe I was, and I believe that the talent was sucked out of me because it got to a point where, as I became older, once I got into college, everything was blocked because then suddenly it became, well, you're disabled, so we're not going to even bother with, you know, giving you a chance, where before I had been given all these chances. You know, it's a lot when a director's like, I want you so badly, I'm going to make a ramp for you. So when those are your messages over and over, you think you're unstoppable, that you can transcend. And isn't that the message that we try to give disabled? You can transcend your disability. And, you know, if you're not getting what you need emotionally, or even physically, you know what I mean? You seek out other places you can fulfill those emotional needs. So I was, you know, trying to fill up this empty cup through performing. And so then once I started getting blocked with, you know, we're not even going to consider you for the audition, where for years that had never been an issue. You know, I've been cast in many musicals. I had the lead in my high school musical. You know, I shared it with two other girls. That I don't know very many disabled people that get the lead in their high school musical, not because we're not talented, but because ableism, really. I hear that story in the theater more than my story, that directors wanted to work with me because I was talented. So to go from that where you're invalidated, and, you know, it's fulfilling your needs as a performer. It's fulfilling your emotional needs. You feel worthwhile because people want you. It was the one place I was wanted was in, as a performer. So then to have that blocked in college, it was very disheartening. What was my future going to be like? So I didn't really get a choice. I ended up getting injured. I fell out of my shower chair and I had to leave school. And that meant I left acting behind. And I was stuck in bed. It was the first time I got stuck in bed. Being stuck in bed has been an on and off again problem for me because of chronic pain and injury. Not because of SMA. That's the thing. People look at me and they say, oh, no, it's because of your SMA. No, if I was rich, if I had the things I needed, if I had access to better medical care, I'm a kid that grew up initially in a trailer park, you know. I'm not from a rich background. I've had to scrape by my whole life. So, not having access to the medical supports I've needed has led to injury, and it's led to me being trapped in bed. And this was the first time. And while I was trapped in bed, I had just recently started dating my girlfriend, and she was a writer. And we said, what can we do together? Because she had to stay home to take care of me, and I couldn't get out to work. And we were literally starving. We were poor, college, starving, young parents. We had a son, and we had to do something. So we started a writing company. We were writing for literally $5 an article. Like, that's how back in the day that was. We started bottom of the barrel and we worked our way up. And eventually I started working with HBO. I started working with Lionsgate. I started working with all these companies. We were reviewing C or DVDs of released television, released movies. And in everything, I was including a paragraph about, is there disability representation? So that's kind of where it began for us in the early 2000s, was like, is disability representation there? And the more I got involved in that, the more I said, if I want to be an actor, I can just make my own work. And that's really what kind of sparked the desire to make media. And it snowballed from there. I went to film school. I took independent studies to learn more about disability representation in film in particular. And what I learned was really disheartening. And so since then, I've been on a mission to make Hollywood more inclusive, not just for me, but for all the other creators like me who have these stories where, you've been told you're talented, but you can never seem to get anywhere because you don't have the funding or you don't have the support, So,
That's
yeah.
so interesting because, like, I didn't know that whole story about you and your partner writing those reviews and stuff, and that's kind of what led to the work you're doing now. That's really fascinating.
Yeah, we did that, and we also so we read we ran a writing and graphic design thing. I was doing really simple graphic design. Like, I remember one of our first clients was a real estate agent, and he made me trace maps of the area, and then I would like make the map of all the cities in the location. So that was a job, and it was a lot of work. And we worked every day, 365 days a year. We didn't take breaks for birthdays. We didn't take breaks for holidays because we literally felt like we had to work endlessly to kind of dig ourselves out of, I don't know what to call it. I guess like disability crud, where you're stuck because you're disabled, and that's the thing they don't tell you. You can't make this much money, and you can't work in certain places, so you have to find non-traditional employment. So it was a lot of that trying to get ahead so that one day we can have an accessible house that has an accessible bathroom.
That's fascinating. And I do want to talk more about your family life and also what you're doing now. But before we do, if everyone could please listen to another brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. If you're living with SMA, the subtle changes that happen from one day to the next can be hard to notice until a key function is lost. Many people find that these changes can impact their life, not just physically, but also emotionally. Since the progression of SMA is relentless, taking action now is important. If you've waited to go on treatment or were told there were no treatments for you, now might be the time to talk to your doctor. Breakthroughs in science have led to more options than ever before in treatment and care. Choosing a disease-modifying treatment can make a difference. Why wait? Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay, so Dom, so now that we're talking about you and your partner, and you mentioned becoming a parent, can you talk more about that? And, you know, me, because I know you just celebrated an anniversary too. So if you can just talk about your relationship there and the way it intersects with caregiving, family life, everything about that.
Yeah, I got really lucky because one of my best friends turned out to be the best life partner I could ever hope for. We were online friends for years, and we just got talking one night and started talking on the phone, and we ended up dating, and she came to visit me at school. We spent a holiday together, so I didn't have to go home because my home life was not really good. My family was really ableist, and I don't really talk with my family because I'm trans. They're not really supportive. So she saved me from having to go home to my family. And we fell in love really, really pretty much from the first moment we were together. We realized, you know, this is it. This is the person I want to be with. And so we've been together 20 years as of last weekend. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary. She was a young mom when we got together. So I kind of informally adopted her son. Adoption is hard when you're disabled, at least in my situation. It's not something where I was able to do it legally at this point, although I always dream of that, but we don't need documents to prove that we're a family. So it would be nice to have them, though. I will say that for the protections and everything.
Sure. Go ahead.
But you don't need blood to make you a family. So he was 7 when we started dating. So I became a parent really young because I was 21 when we got together. So, but it was nice. I really wanted kids. So we've wanted more. That's been a struggle for me, is not having more kids. But the reality is when you're trans, especially, and disabled, they don't want to give you opportunities to have children. I was not given access to preserve my eggs when I had my hysterectomy, for example, which is something they commonly offer trans people that are not disabled. And I feel like society has basically said, well, you already have one, so you're ahead of the curve. You're lucky. But I missed out on so much of his earlier years that I really wish we would have had the opportunity to have more kids. And I think it's something we're still kind of thinking about as we get older. But, you know, it kind of feels like time is running out a bit.
No, and I appreciate you sharing that. And that brings me to a question, too, about your activism is very prominent in the disability and in the LGBTQ community. So can you talk about the intersection of those identities as disabled and trans and what that means to you and how it's taken you toward this path toward activism and being really engaged in the communities you're a part of?
Yeah. So I think my early years in as this poster child really kind of evolved in towards my activism as well, because, I was exploited. Like terribly. I call what MDA does pimping for profit, because they literally use little kids. They used my body. I remember I was at an event and a man said, if you sit on my lap, I'll donate. And it was like a huge amount. I don't remember how much it was. And my mom was like, sure. You know, my mom was like, sure. Yeah. You know, and I did it. And I remember feeling like this is my obligation. I have to do this, you know, And I got so many amazing opportunities that you know, other kids don't get. So you tell yourself it's enough, it's good enough. You know, I was playing on stages in bands as a 10-year-old, as a tambourine player at, you know, events. They put me in dunk tanks, you know, when I was 10, and you'd get to dunk me, you know, and it's like exploitation. You're not getting paid a cent for it, but your worth is all wrapped up in it. So then, you know, I'm like, I'm miserable. I'm suicidal. I hate myself. I want to kill myself because that's all the worth I see in myself is, you know, I'm better to y'all dead than I am alive. So when I was saying that, I was thinking that's not normal. That's not, you shouldn't be thinking that. But society was like, well, you're disabled. Of course you feel this way. So they were validating my suicidal ideation. They were not saying you're depressed, which it was. I was depressed at the time. I was diagnosed with anxiety. It's the first mental health disability that I was diagnosed with. I also have ADHD, and that was ignored. It's really not easy to know when quote unquote girls have ADHD, like, because it doesn't always display as hyperactivity. But also I couldn't move as well. So here I was racing my wheelchair in circles and they weren't saying, oh, this kid has hyperactivity. You know, I would literally go around my classroom in the big lecture halls. Like I would just wheel my wheelchair around. The teachers didn't say a word. They felt like they couldn't tell the disabled kid, you know, stop moving your wheelchair. But like, gosh, what a distraction I must have been to everybody. And I just couldn't help myself. I could not just sit still. I had to spin around or else I couldn't concentrate. And, you know, but they said you're physically disabled. So they didn't want to acknowledge that I had this other thing. And I also think it affected my ability to communicate with other disabled people. And it's why other people with SMA and other people with neuromuscular disability rejected me, because they're like, you're this little weirdo, you know, you're hyper, your brain works so fast that, and your thoughts come out that way, you know, so I would be on topic after topic after topic, and it was always brilliant, but people could never keep up with me. So it was easier to just be like, you know, you're a weirdo, so we don't want to be a part of, you know, to be a part of that. So even within the disabled community, they're saying you're the wrong kind of disabled. We don't want you. So that was a message that I got. And I think all of these like negative messages really led me towards the, well, how can I counter this? And that's what activism really is countering all this noise that's saying you're worthless, you're not good enough, you're not as human as other people, you don't deserve what other people have. You know, I wanted to counter that. So when I got to the second university I attended, it was a university designed specifically where a lot of disabled people went. We had underground tunnels where you could go in the winter so your wheelchairs didn't get damaged or have to deal with snow. So like being in that environment and seeing other disabled people, I'd never been in a place with other disabled people in the same way. MBA had basically kind of controlled all the disabled people when we were together. Like we all kind of thought, well, we're really lucky to be here. We're really lucky to be alive. You know what I mean? And when you're coming from that place, you're not coming from a place of equality to begin with. When I went to this university, it was people with all kinds of disabilities. So it was kind of like you had people that were still internally, you know, dealing with ableism like I was. You had people that were told their whole life that there was nothing, nothing different, that their disability didn't make them less valuable. So, having so many different perspectives made me see that my perspective was not necessarily the right one, And so I was inspired by other disabled people to get into activism because that's what they were doing. They were advocating for themselves. There was an independent living movement on my campus, basically. And so being integrated into that, the natural progression went from this kind of victim mentality, which I think is what MDA kind of creates, is we're all victims of quote unquote SMA or neuromuscular disability. So we got to fix that. We got to make us no longer victims to, I'm a human being and I have needs that are not being fulfilled. That's an entirely different script. So, and since then, once I realized I had that dialogue, it was kind of no looking back for me. I became the person MDA hated, really. And that was my role, sadly. And MDA turned their backs on me. But the thing was, they had already turned their backs. I was no longer cute. I was no longer profitable the same way. So I wasn't as valuable to them. So it was okay that MDA turned their back on me because I turned my back on them too. I realized that my life was worth something, and I realized that I, as a person, deserved better treatment. I deserved, at the very least, to be treated like a human being, and that was not happening. So, how could I demand that change? That's where my activism began, and I think that that's still where it is. I'm not just asking that question for me, though. I'm asking, how can we make it so all disabled people are treated like they're human beings? Because at the very basic level, we all deserve basic human decency, and we don't get that. We don't. Most disabled people get treated as less than. And so if we have to start there, that's where I start.
Dom, again, thank you so much for sharing and being very open there. And I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now. So, you talked about the journey toward media representation and also and like analyzing disability representation in media, and that got you into filmmaking and screenwriting and everything else. So, what are some of the and then you of course did the Spaces video last year, which we did the episode on. So what are some of the things you're doing now, whether it's in filmmaking, academia, whatever your the kind of things on your radar right now?
Right now, Ashton, who is my life and work partner, and I, we run the Film Dis Study into Disability Representation on Television. It's a comprehensive study that examines disability from all aspects. So I can tell you everything about the state of representation, particularly on television. But in my experience, television mirrors other forms of representation, particularly film, but also where we see representation in books, in Broadway, and even in new media. So the study, which is available on our website at filmdis.com, we're about to have 3 years of study data issued. I'm about to write the third paper because we are just getting back our data sets from our data analyst who compiled all the data. What we do is we watch every single episode of every single show that we are able to within a 1 year period. The last 2 years, we've watched 250 shows amongst the two of us. We make sure to watch every single episode so that we can list every form of disability representation from lead characters to extras. We can tell you that. We can tell you what their gender is, what the racial breakup is amongst disability, what the breakup is beyond specific disability. So we know how each community of disability is represented. We also can tell you where they're from. Like most of them are American because we are primarily doing English speaking language shows. And although there are quite a bit of British and Australian representation, there is a bit of British and Australian representation as well. And we find a variety of other nations represented, but it is mostly the English speaking world because that's what we focus on. If we did all television, I don't think two people would be capable of doing that many shows because we're talking hundreds and hundreds of shows come out every year. As it is, we're doing 250, and that's not all of the shows. With better funding, we can hire more people to do more work. So we're trying to find more funding, grant money for that. So if you're listening and you have any grant money, please feel free to reach out because it is a lot of work, but it is very important. One of the most important things we also calculate is not whether the character is played by someone who is actually disabled or not, or whether we even know that info. So we're pretty much experts on representation on television. That's our first thing we do. The other thing we do is we're writing scripts. We have a television show ready to go. I believe that our casting practices would help revolutionize casting in Hollywood because we don't believe in just saying, well, it says you're a disabled role, so then we're going to call you in. We believe disabled people should be allowed to audition for any roles they could logically play. And that's how we wish to cast our shows. So we have one show ready to go. We're in the midst of writing four or five others. We're really excited about it because all of our shows offer representation in various forms. We believe they represent the world a lot more legitimately than we see, where not just from the aspect where we don't see much disability, but even, when it comes to not really seeing the intersection of disability and LGBT, you wanted me to kind of talk about that. And there's a huge level of overlap. And that's because marginalized people, marginalized communities are more likely to have higher rates of disability just from the aspect of mental health and chronic health. You are more likely to have chronic health issues because of stress, because of prejudice, because of mistreatment that can both impact mental health and chronic health. It can also impact physical health. We see people that become physically disabled because of this stress. So, the fact that we don't see this spoken about or even represented is a problem because the crossover is big enough to where over half of the LGBT people has been recorded as having some form of disability. So I don't often feel represented. I don't often feel seen because we don't see that form of representation. I actually want to bring attention to what's going on the L word because there's a story where someone with a neuromuscular disability is playing a character that is dating a trans character. So, it's really what the L word's doing is what I haven't really seen a lot of other television shows doing. And it's interesting to me that it's such a simple thing. They're not doing anything that's going hugely above and beyond. I feel like Hollywood would say they are though, like, oh my gosh, this is so like above and beyond everything, but it's like, no, it's so natural. It's so, I hate to use the word normal, but I mean, we all know what that means. It's so mundane. It's just two people that happen to be disabled and trans that are dating, and why is the disabled community not talking about this,
Well, I think what you're getting at, it's like anytime there's representation, it gets like applauded and like, oh, look how good we're doing. But really, it's like, okay, that's just that should be more the standard rather than the exception.
Well, I think we should be talking about what Jillian Mercado is doing on the L Word, because this is what we want Hollywood to be doing. This is what I hear people complaining about all the time, is where is the representation? And now, and so, and she is a woman dating a trans man. So, it's queer representation in some way, but it's also, kind of queer, it's a woman dating a trans man or a man, you know what I mean? And I feel like we don't even get to see those kind of relationships where men and women get to date. So adding elements where there's trans people, where there's queer representation in this show, that's largely, it's about queer women, it's about trans people, they're doing more than other shows are right now. Is, I'm so excited just even talking about it that I can hardly get my words out, because I don't get to celebrate representation so much. And the new season is just beginning, and there's supposed to be a big story with Jillian and Leo Sheng's character, who is the trans character, and I'm Oh, Micah. Micah's the name. I was totally blanking on names. So they're supposed to have a big storyline. Possibly, I don't know if this is where it's going, but I think it involves wanting to have children or talking about having children. A huge, huge issue that we don't see spoken about when it comes to wheelchair users in particular. So yeah, so I'm really glad that I get to talk about this now, because I feel like when I come on podcasts and whatnot, they're always like, well, what representation are you talking about? And it's always, oh, they're doing something horrible. There's a non-disabled person, playing us. And here we are, we actually have a disabled person playing a disabled role in. The role is not written about the disability, but the disability is not ignored. Like, for example, in one episode, they are going to have sex, and there's a discussion about, how do they get Jillian to the bed? That's a realistic representation of disability. It does not ignore the fact that she's disabled, but it also doesn't make it a big deal. It's like they want to have sex, so they found the way. And that's how it is for us. We find the way no matter what.
Well, I was hoping for a good recommendation with as much as media as you watch and consume. That's great to hear. That's awesome.
There is one other thing we are doing too, and that is in the spring or early summer, I plan to be teaching classes. I come from a family of teachers, so teaching is kind of something I understand. I have helped with many a lesson plan back in the day. I also, when I was in college, I would get the opportunity to teach kids acting sometimes. So I really loved being someone who could teach performing. So it really excites me to announce that I am going to be teaching two different classes. One of them geared towards screenwriters, and one of them geared towards actors. Right now, I'm trying to find more scholarships, but as of now, we have two scholarships specifically for disabled screenwriters to apply for, and two scholarships specifically for disabled actors to apply for. So I really hope that I can get the whole class funded so that we can get scholarships to everyone, because as a disabled person, I recognize that things are expensive, and knowledge is expensive. So I want to make sure that I can be able to offer more classes, you know, through getting paid, but also not force the burden of having to pay so much on disabled people. So
that's fantastic. And yeah, that's really cool to have, yeah, the teaching background comes into play, and yeah, hopefully we'll get, you know, a lot of disabled students in both of those. So that's awesome.
Yes, yes. And really, my goal is in the fact that I hear disabled people, and as a former disabled actor, I can attest to this. Disabled actors are saying classes are not always available to us. They're not accessible to us, and they're not always geared to us. So I really wanted to have classes that are helping train the next generation of creators in Hollywood, because we don't have that, or even from a disabled perspective, we don't have people teaching filmmaking or acting or whatnot from the perspective of someone who is disabled.
No, and that's huge. I think it's good. I mean, because it's like people don't realize why so many opportunities aren't available to people in our community, because it comes down to accessibility and to a number of factors that, you know, make it just actually available for disabled actors and other artists to pursue those things.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was also why we want to try to find the scholarships. And if any disabled or any organizations, because the classes are not just for disabled creators. I'm also thinking about trans creators that are not always given access to Hollywood. The classes, these two classes will be focused on disability though. So I think it'll be interesting if, you know, some writers that are not disabled are also, you know, other marginalized writers come and they kind of learn, you know, about disabled representation and whatnot, you know, because I feel like we have to not only teach ourselves, but everybody else about disability as well, because then, you know, you can't recognize the harm you're creating if you don't know it's happening.
Well, Dom, thanks again so much for coming on today. And just wrapping up here, is there any other advice or message you want to share with others in the SMA community who are listening?
When people tell you can't do it, don't believe them. If you believe you can do something, if you know your body, you know your talent, don't let them tell you no, because I've been told no so much. I failed so much. And, you know, we always hear about you've succeeded and you've done that, but I don't think people tell you. I failed at things, and I really have. You know, I've been a failure at so many things, and a lot of it is because of ableism, but sometimes it's just because, you know, there are other people you're up against and whatnot. But realize that if you believe in yourself, you should never give up in what you want to do. Because I think that's the biggest thing, is that we're told, well, you're just not good enough, so you should just give up. And I don't think that that's the kind of message that we as disabled people should be getting, because we're already getting all these other messages. So I'm here to tell you, keep trying. You will find your way.
That's fantastic. And Dom, I just want to thank you so much for coming on today, sharing your story. And we'll also put links to your website and social media in the description, but thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Absolutely. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can connect with us directly on our forums and follow us at smanewstoday.com for all the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.